This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Blood of a Thousand Stars by Rhoda Baeza. Read for you by Rebecca Soler. Part 1. The Returned. An organic memory is an act of creation, of recreation, in fact, and by definition, an imperfect copy, corrupted by emotion and an overload of sensory details. A memory recalled via the cube, however, is the exact memory perfectly preserved. It's argued such recollections are less visceral, or that something essential is lost, but it seems little cost for the truth in returning to the same moment countless times, unchanged. G1K Summit Appeal to the United Planets, the year 858. Chapter 1. Kara. If Kara was hot up here, it must have been hell down in the packed square. All of Now Fruma was on a labor strike, and from her vantage point, the protesters looked like a single living organism, angry, undulating. For a historically neutral moon, Now Fruma was not exactly peaceful these days. Sweat stung Kara's eyes as she scanned the crowd below. She wiped it away with the back of her hand, smearing the moon dust that had settled on her skin. "Test," she said to Pavel, the small droid who sat beside her. The heat made everything shimmer in the distance. 6 o'clock. A bright white light flashed across the terracotta brick building directly behind them. It was gone in a split second. Kara scratched at the surface of the rusty coin, the one she'd carried around always. It hadn't been anything more than a good luck charm until Lydia told her otherwise.
"This binds you to your family. There's history in this coin," she'd said with her dying breath.
Kara blinked away the memory. "Again, Pavel. 9 o'clock. Pavel swiveled west and used a small mirror attachment to reflect the sunlight. "Again, 2 o'clock. All right, take it easy," Allie said as he climbed up the wire ladder that led to the roof. "You're more intense than half the souls I came up with in basic." He crouched down next to Kara, half hidden by the ledge.
"Just trying to prep," she said, pocketing the coin.
He had no idea how militant Lydia had been. The woman Kara had thought was her mother had a consummate work ethic. Language testing, survival training, ways to smuggle credits, and how to get a good read on a person. Kara had thought it was absurd and paranoid, which showed how much she knew. It had paid off in a way. Kara had survived, even if Lydia hadn't.
"You keep prepping, and someone down there might notice our little operation."
"They're too busy watching the picket line." It had been 2 days since Kara and Allie had gotten to Now Fruma, and just one day since Empress Rhiannon Ta'an had come forward to announce she was alive. Since Now Fruma was a moon of Kalu, news of her return home was all over the Hollows. Kara would have been relieved about her sister's safe return, but the Hollows were also buzzing with the newest speculation. Where Jocelyn Ta'an was, Rhiannon's older sister. If anyone in the universe knew the answer to that question, it was Kara. Because Kara was Jocelyn. Or she had been once, even if she didn't remember. After informing the galaxy that she was alive, Rhi had outed Kara, offering a reward for her safe return. Actually, she had offered a reward for Jocelyn, the missing royal sister and rightful empress, the one who everyone believed had died all those years ago in a spacecraft explosion, along with the rest of the Ta'an family. Maybe Kara should have been moved by the gesture. She didn't have a single memory before the age of 12. Lydia had told her it was a cube malfunction. Kara had believed it all those years, and filled in the big white blank space of her mind with made-up scenarios. and she'd gotten so good at it that soon she was spinning entire tales, fabricating alternate lives on the spot while kids at parties nodded their heads, wide-eyed and amazed. Underneath all the lies she'd told, the lies she'd been told, she had a true family and a real home. But what did blood really matter? Rhiannon was a stranger in every other sense of the word, and seeing her on the Hollows brought on a slew of feelings about a lot of people, most of them dead and gone. Lydia, the scientist who had harbored her, her actual parents, the late Emperor and Empress of Kalu, whom she hardly remembered, and Rhiannon, the girl who'd come back from the dead, who was in the process of assuming her crown, while Kara crouched on a hot roof, hiding for her life. Allie unscrewed a canteen and took a big gulp, his head tipped back, his mouth parted. Kara turned away and tried to focus. She squinted at the doorway across the way. Her bangs fell into her face, and she pawed at them, annoyed. "These will help," Allie said. From his messenger bag, he pulled out a bulky hunk of black metal that looked like two cups attached side by side. "They're called binoculars. Vintage military gear. They magnify your vision." Apparently, you could find anything on the black market. She took the binoculars and put them to her eyes. They were heavier than they looked, and everything came out blurry and small. "They don't work." "You have them upside down," he said, shaking his head and grinning in that way that made her forget her life was on fire. "I knew that," she lied. Kara put the device to her eyes and immediately regretted it. The view was disorienting, claustrophobic, too narrow. She could only see a small cluster of people at a time. She ripped it away from her face and nearly dropped it. "Whoa," Allie said, grabbing it from her hand. "Everything okay?" She shook her head. "I feel kind of dizzy." She realized she had a headache, a light pulsing behind her eye. It wasn't the binoculars. The meds Lydia had given her were running low. Kara had been taking them for years. Lydia told her the pills were to help manage the severe headaches and nightmares from her cube malfunction. And even if they treated her symptoms just fine, Kara had discovered that the cause was a lie. The pills did help with the headaches, but they were DNA suppressors, too, meant to skew Jocelyn's features. Lydia's own biological design, if Kara had to guess. For the last couple of weeks, she'd been weaning herself off by taking half doses, then quarter doses, to fractions of a pill every other day. This morning, she'd broken a pill apart without a knife, and most of it crumbled to dust. Kara had almost cried. Not that she could tell you why. There's something about the end of one simple routine that tethered you to your past. Even if it was a lie. "You take it," Kara said, handing the binoculars back. "Narrate for me."
"Well, you're not missing much," he said, staring into the binoculars. "Just a bunch of pissed off nowies."
He rubbed the back of his neck like he always did when he was thinking. His shirt lifted up to reveal a strip of dark skin, his belly button a tiny outie, dimples on the inside of either hip.
"Are you well, Kara? I detect a sudden but minor change in your skin color."
Pavel's eye lights went red.
"The medical Bible says this is a common physiological reaction to emotional stressors. Blood vessels open wide, flooding the skin with blood and reddening the face."
"It's called blushing," Allie said. He dropped the binoculars. The corners of his mouth had turned up just slightly.
"You're a rat," Kara nudged Pavel with the tip of her boot so that he rolled back with the force. She felt herself flushing more.
"I'll open up that head of yours and rearrange all the inside bits," she threatened.
"Better watch out, little man."
"This is humor, correct?" Pavel's eye lights had gone red. Because, theoretically, we're not too far off. There's new research to suggest that cube-to-cube transfers could be enhanced. Nearby neural pathways can give and receive the info without even being prepped, without even... Allie dropped the hand with the binoculars. All right, P, he said, all the playfulness drained from his voice. Chill out. She was just kidding. Have him try me, Kara tried to joke, but the mood had already shifted. Allie knew she didn't like talking about their cubes. The mere mention put her on edge, reminded her they had all turned theirs off in case Nero was trying to track them right now. Allie closed the gap between them and slid his palm into hers. She tried to ignore the way it lit her skin on fire. You okay? He asked. I'm fine, she said, slipping her hand out of his grasp. Allie gave her that look he made when he was trying to get a read on her, the slight pout in his full lips, his brown eyes opened wide so his thick lashes fanned out. He had a cut across his left eyebrow, the same spot where he'd nicked it when he was younger. But this time around, it had been the kid, Julian, who'd done it to Allie. Julian hadn't exactly been thrilled when they landed on his doorstep looking for the Lancer. In fact, he got so intense that he'd caused a scene, calling them thieves and managing to get a jab in when Allie was trying to hold him down. But as soon as help came, all they did was scold Julian and apologize to Kara and Allie, who did their damnedest to keep their faces hidden. Apparently, Julian had acted up after his dad died, and his being known as a hothead worked in their favor. Since then, Allie, Kara, and Pavel had been trailing him, but they kept their distance. Julian was their only connecting thread to the Lancer, and the information he should have given her before his death. Kara was sure it had to do with the location of the Overrider, the same technology that Lydia had used to hack into Kara's cube and erase her memories of being Jocelyn. The same technology Lydia had told her about before she died. The technology that Kara wanted to destroy. But first, she had to find it, and they didn't have a whole lot to go on. The three of them had combed all available information about the G1K summits, where the galaxy's scientists got together to develop the cube, but nothing concrete turned up in any of the policies, ethical standards, reports, or updates. Kara even did a deep dive into the conspiracy theories about the Overrider, and some suggested a kind of prototype had been developed in the Outer Belt, which functioned by deleting simple memories stored on people's cubes via a giant shared network that rivaled Uniforces. But Kara already knew that, since it was her memories that had once been removed, and it didn't give her any new information. There had always been rumors. They needed something concrete, and their only lead was Julian. Now, Kara waited for Julian to leave the dojo, like he did every afternoon. She squinted back down at the crowd. Today, she would finally get inside. If I could choose any superpower, I'd read your mind, Allie said. You don't want to be in there, she shook her head. It's all messed up. I want to see all of it, even the messed up parts, Allie told her. He moved closer so that their shoulders were touching. Especially the messed up parts. Kara fought the urge to look over at him, but gave in anyway. Your eyes, he said softly, their lips a breath apart. She looked at that little spot at the center of his upper lip, where it dipped in just so. They're changing color again. Kara blinked. The rest of the world rushed back in. She felt like she'd woken up from a spell. Havel! She called back and demanded his mirror when he rolled close, bringing it to her face. I didn't mean anything, Allie had started to say. But Kara shook her head. She saw it. The golden hue of her left iris. The tiny specks of green dotting the center. They haven't changed that much, Allie said, backtracking. Kara's tongue felt thick.
They had changed.
She was different. The faint headache suddenly became an intense throbbing behind her right eye. She fished the eye drops out of her pocket. They had quick-fix DNA suppression properties to keep her eyes the same color. The liquid burned when she dropped it on her cornea.
Hey, Allie said, taking her hand again. I don't know why I even said anything. I can barely tell.
She didn't pull away this time, but looked down at the way their fingers interlaced, and how his knuckles were red and raw from everything he'd been through in the last few weeks. It felt like a lifetime had passed since they met on the Zeppelin. The world was at war. Everything had changed, including her face.
You're a terrible liar, she said.
4 o'clock, Pavel announced.
Allie squeezed her hand. We're done with the drills, P, he called behind them.
Not a drill. Target at 4 o'clock.
Kara ripped the binoculars from Allie's hand and looked in the direction Pavel had called. There was Julian, exiting a structure with his telltale slouch.
Kara locked eyes for a fleeting moment with Allie before they gathered their things and each threw their Duhat on.
You know what to do, Pavel, Allie called as he and Kara quickly made their way down the ladder. She was so nervous she was half sliding, half falling, and suddenly they had boots on the top floor and were flying down the steps to the street level. She burst out of the door, right into the crowded streets of the protest. Allie was by her side, pulling her back.
Slow it down, he said, adjusting the fabric of her Duhat.
But urgency coursed through her limbs. They were going to break into someone's spot. Julian was connected to the Lancer, their only lead. And he'd known Rhee, was friends with her even, judging by how defensive he'd gotten when he saw Kara's matching coin. But they were also in the middle of a protest, surrounded by a whole lot of guards eager to use their stunners if you gave them a reason. A light flashed again at 4 o'clock from the lookout point, Pavel's signal of Julian's location. Julian was headed home. Kara dove into the crowd. Allie was right behind her. The mass pushed forward, chanting and hollering about fair pay and lower export taxes for goods to the moon. She followed with a singular purpose, pushing her way through the crowd as the light hopped from building to building, all in a row, moving farther and farther away. Finally, they reached the dome-shaped threshold, and Kara looked up to confirm one last time that the light was far away. She reached behind her to find Allie's hand. But he was no longer there. Kara got on the tips of her toes and looked for him, but he was nowhere, lost to the crowd. She'd been sure he was behind her. If she waited, she might miss her window. From her observations, she'd learned there were only 15 minutes during the day when the temple was unused. That alone had been enough to convince her that whatever the Lancer had given his son was likely stored there, where it would be under near constant guard. Looking toward the tower, she raised a hand to signal Pavel. She was going in. Inside was a short hallway that led her through another threshold and into a long room with high ceilings. Bamboo mats lined the floor, and a row of wooden pillars ran down the center. Material imported from Kalu, no doubt. There was no way a dusty moon like this had enough water to grow bamboo. Light flooded in through paneled windows all along the east and west walls. It was empty. Still, it vibrated with the intensity and violence she'd always associated with martial arts. There was a small altar against the wall in the center of the room, with only one hollow, one ancestor, Vayron, otherwise known as the Lancer. Kara had practically memorized his face. She'd come across countless images of him during all the research she'd done in the last 2 days. In every available image, he wore a stark expression, his mouth in a line so straight it was practically a grimace. The high brow and darker coloring of his Raten side, the intimidating stare of his ice-blue eyes.
but in this hollow, he had the hint of a smile. And it was taken outside, the sun's glow warm on his skin, making it look tanner, more alive. Scattered across the altar were simple offerings, a few pieces of fruit, a bowl of grain, and an old stick of incense burned down to its nub. One item stood out, a cylinder made up of small wooden pieces of all different sizes and lengths, jigsawed together. The whole thing fit into the palm of Kara's hand. When she lifted it, a beam emitted from its center and panned across her eyes. For a split second, she was blinded. The blue beam widened, and a hollow of the galaxy appeared, a sprawling image that took up the length of the dojo and made Kara dizzy with its scope. Kara heard a door slam behind her. She jumped back, dropping the cylinder. It clattered to the ground, and the hollow disappeared into a sliver. She turned and saw him. Julian. He looked even taller than he had a few days ago. He stood with his feet apart, his hands and fists.
What are you doing here?
I was looking for you, Kara said smoothly. The lie came easy, even if her heart was racing and her head was throbbing. Of all days for Julian to come back. She couldn't help but notice he'd blocked the entrance she'd come through, and the exit she'd been intending to use. His blue eyes fell on the cylinder. Its surfaces had reconfigured into an asymmetrical triangle.
How did you get it to unlock?
I didn't unlock it. Kara tried to keep her voice steady as he paced toward her. Could she get around him? There was a second door on the far side of the room, but she didn't know where it led. I just picked it up.
You're lying.
Then,
tell me what it said.
So there was a message. Kara knew that this was what Lydia had intended her to find. That it was a message only Kara, not Julian, not anyone, could have opened. Outside, something slammed into the window. Kara could make out the figure from the inside, a dark form crouching low as it pressed itself against the window. Instinctively, Kara and Julian both crouched. The beating of her heart matched the pounding of her head. Right then and there, Kara made a decision. When Julian's head was turned toward the window, Kara lunged past him, grabbing the wooden device in her hand.
No!
He dove for her. His hand caught her foot, and she flew forward, knees and elbows breaking her fall. The device tumbled forward out of her hands, and Julian let her go to scramble for it, but Kara was faster getting to her feet. Kara scooped up the device and hurtled out the door, relieved to see a staircase. The noise of chanting and shouting in the market was louder here. She was headed in the right direction.
What did it say?
Julian's voice echoed back to her, even as she pinballed up the steps, crashing around the twists and turns, making bruises she'd find only later. She burst into the sunlight and threw herself into the rioting crowd. Chapter 2. Rhiannon. Rhi no longer looked like a marked child. The suction of the octoweresis had faded, and her skin was once again the color of smooth sand. It had been just 2 days since Rhi announced her homecoming via a hijacked holovision channel. The fisherman, who had helped Rhi and Dalin escape from Nero's clutches after he'd found her on Fontis, had then reached out for help to a disparate network of anarchists, who didn't care one bit about restoring Rhi to her crown, but did care about the credits they received in return for their assistance. Shuttled in a series of unmarked crafts, flying under the radar of the very army Rhi should command, she arrived on Kalu under the cover of night. Now, from the back seat of the ground vehicle, she looked out of the tinted glass and saw the streets of Cebu, lined on either side with thousands of Kalusians who'd come out to welcome her home. Colorful paper lanterns were hung all over the capital city, from balconies and over doorways.
Those are for us, Jocelyn had said once, when they'd returned from an extended family trip. You mean they're for me, too? Rhee had asked. That's what us means, Joss had said. She had always found a way to make Rhee feel silly and stupid and young. And just when the hope had started to deflate, Jocelyn had nudged Rhee with her shoulder and smiled. It was then that Rhee knew. They were a team. She was the sidekick. She'd follow Joss anywhere. She fished the coin out of her pocket. It was from the Bezoral Quadrant, from a time before they used credits. These pieces of metal had held value once, and her father had brought two home from a diplomatic mission. One for her, and one for Joss. Rhee had only recently learned Joss was still alive, that she'd managed to survive the accident that tragically killed the rest of their family. But Rhee couldn't find her. Joss could be anywhere in the entire galaxy, and Rhee had to abandon her search before it had even started, coming home instead to claim the throne. Nero had forced her hand. He knew Jocelyn was alive. The best Rhee could do was offer a reward for her sister's safe return, and hope she could get to her before Nero did. She had to end this war and stop his rise before he wrested control of her rule entirely. In truth, she wanted to kill him, too. But she'd spilt enough blood, and she'd learned her revenge fantasies were just that. Fantasies. Her trainer, Vayron, was dead. Andres Siotra, former regent to the Kalu crown, was dead. A trail of bodies, of destruction, lay in her wake. She should know better. Cut off the thought of revenge at the root, because it hadn't paid off. And it wouldn't this time either. She needed to be smarter, more strategic. Bloodshed wasn't the answer when she was trying to end a war between Kalu and Fontis. If anything, Nero's murder would only incite more violence. The ground vehicle switched gears, jolting her out of her meditation.
Don't concern yourself, Dallin spoke up from the front seat.
The Fontisian's eyes in the rearview mirror were gray. They shifted hues depending on the light.
I've scouted out the location, and the central district is where we're the most vulnerable. Extra archers have been placed there and there, he said as he pointed.
Rhee's eyes wandered to the tattoos across his neck. Detailed swirls that she imagined were beyond painful to receive. He must have mistaken her distant gaze for worry. It was the closest he had ever come to asking whether she was okay. She searched for the right words, the ones to ground her in this moment, to explain every ounce of emotion that burdened her. Thank you for being so thorough. He'd taken the security detail seriously. But for all his skill in combat, he'd misunderstood the enemy. Nero would never attempt a move against her with so many people watching. She wasn't afraid for her life. She was afraid of his mind, the vindictive ways he used people and pitted them against each other, as if they were all pieces on a chessboard. Rhee looked down and realized her fists were clenched in the cloth of her dress. Last time she'd worn the ceremonial red dress, Rhee had been forced to kill Vayron, her trainer, the man she had loved like a second father. Fought him off with everything she'd had, stabbed him in the heart, and sent him off into space, because Nero had deemed it so. Every thought, every memory of Vayron made her chest tighten, and led her back to Julian, his son. He'd been her best friend when there was nothing else good in the world, when her family had died and she'd been cast to now Fruma. If Julian discovered her betrayal, it would be one he'd never forgive. She'd finally summoned the courage to reach out to him. Since her cube was off, Rhee had been forced to use a radio telescope, a near-ancient piece of tech, at a safe house pit stop along the way. She had to speak into a receiver to record her voice, and hope it made its way to the one radio telescope at an observatory on now Fruma.
There's so much to tell you, she'd said. And if that transmitted to him successfully, someone would have to be at the telescope at the moment it came in to receive it. It was a long shot, but the only one Rhi had. She wasn't sure what he might have heard about his father's death, or what he might believe, but she'd needed to try. And if she failed to get through to him this time, she'd try again and again. If he was attempting to get hold of her, Rhi wouldn't know. If she finally succeeded, what would she say? Did he know about her part in Vairin's death? Would she tell him? Honor. Bravery. Loyalty. It was her mantra. Her Mata'an Sarili. Her highest self. Rhi focused on the spot between her eyes and felt a touch of numbness that grew through her skull until everything was clear, dark, without context, and without pain. When she'd centered herself, she opened her eyes to see Dalin scowling out the windshield. She'd never seen him smile, and she wondered if she ever would, especially not since what had happened on Hul, when Nero made Dalin turn on his cube, forcing him to violate one of the sacred vows of the Order. Since then, Dalin had become both more intense and more withdrawn, though she hadn't thought either possible. Are you okay? Rhi wished she'd sat in the front, by his side, rather than having him up front alone, as if he were hired help. Why hadn't she thought of it earlier? If he'd registered her question, she couldn't be sure. But she noticed the ends of his pointy ears went red.
The fisherman chose the snipers personally, Dalin said. You won't miss them, if you look closely.
Rhi decided not to press it. There would be time to talk later. Squinting out the window, she saw archers were placed strategically within each of the twin towers of the Long Now. The rounded white buildings had lush, green terraces spiraling up their length, a new addition to the city in the 6 years she'd been gone. These were the Drone Vision headquarters, where Nero himself lived, and she didn't doubt he had his own snipers strategically placed. She was glad for Dalin, his command, his archers. Her Tassin, the royal guard that had protected the Ta'an family for generations of rule, could no longer be trusted in the transition of power. As far as Rhi was concerned, they worked for Nero. It was a Tassin who'd dragged her to Nero's little production when he had lorded over Dalin's body, prepared to extract his cube, to ravage his memories on the spot. It was only weeks before, but so much had happened. Maybe the Tassin believed the same silly fairy tale Nero spun over and over again. He was going to improve Kalu's standing in the galaxy. He'd focus on getting the crops back in order, bring all the farmers back, revive an industry long dead so they could find wealth once more. An exclusive, thriving world just for them. Them being the wealthy second wavers who'd built their fortune on Kalu's agricultural industry. But they had squeezed it dry, demanding too great a yield from the planet's natural resources so they could sell it to the highest bidder on some far-flung planet. Now the second wavers watched their fortunes dwindle and blamed nearly anyone except themselves and their own terrible choices. Which is why they wanted all the immigrants and Raitan refugees out. Behind the confetti, the roses, the hopeful mood that had infused the city, an undercurrent of tension buzzed everywhere. Kalu was at war with Fontis. Even if you couldn't see it here, you could feel it. They'd passed people holding the collusion flag upside down, witnessed signs of poverty at the base of the lush, gleaming tower. Rhi had anticipated her homecoming would infuriate Nero's supporters. She had come to displace him, after all, and reclaim the throne and leadership of all of Kalu. But Nero remained as slick as oil when it was announced she was returning home.
"Thank the ancestors," he'd said, citing those he did not pray to, and a religion he did not practice. The public ate it up. Never mind the fact he'd been publicly rallying to avenge her death by going to war with Fontus. He could hardly admit to having been the one to orchestrate her attempted assassination. From what she could tell on the Hollows she'd watched during her flight here, dissenters were in the minority. A loud minority, however. It was nothing Rhee hadn't heard before. That she was too young, too beholden to her family's dynasty, too attached to the monarchy that had led the planet down the wrong path. But now she saw their ranks had swelled. Or were there always this many people who welcomed the war with Fontus? Humiliation started to sink down into her bones as they passed a burning effigy of a brown doll in a red dress with black yarn for hair. There were cheers. Then a woman snatched it away and threw it on the ground, stomping the limp figure. Rhee wasn't sure if she'd done it to put out the fire or to demonstrate what she thought of the Empress. She looked away. Was it true? Was she as young and naive as they accused her of being? It was clear now, more than ever, that the Second Wavers were becoming a sort of ruling class. They led the charge on the anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, and now the growing anti-native sentiment here in Cebu. And if they were against native blood, it meant they were against the Ta'an, against her. They hadn't even given Rhee the chance to fail. Instead, they gravitated toward Nero, an evil, corrupt killer. The masses had already come to love watching him night after night on drone vision for over a decade as the ambassador to the regent, and thus had come to trust him, too. Earlier that morning, he had announced a territory-wide update to the Cube operating system, the first in years, and a rollout was already in progress for those who opted in. The Hollows were broadcasting the news across the system. It gave Rhee a knot in her stomach, though an update seemed innocent enough. Still, everything Nero did was twisted at the root. He may have tricked an entire solar system into thinking that he was their champion, but Rhee would help them. Her father had said being a ruler was difficult, sometimes thankless, and such a remark had puzzled her. Everywhere they'd gone, he was showered with praise, with gifts, asked to dole out blessings, people longing to touch him with their outstretched hands. Now she understood an inkling of that sentiment. She'd end the war. Two wars, in fact. A war where soldiers were sent off to die, and the emotional war for the hearts and minds of her own people, here, in the very city she was born. Nero had been a heartbeat away from proclaiming himself regent. She'd temporarily snatched the position from him. But he would never cede power so easily, even if he had ostensibly agreed to step back. She would do what her father had done and unite everyone in peace. Even if the way she might achieve that peace was as thorny and thick in her mind as one of the dozen-armed cacti in the desert of now Fruma. The only certainty Rhee had was that she was a Ta'an. She could do it. She had to. As she and Dalin and the rest of her guards moved toward the center city, traffic narrowed to a slow crawl. The streets were packed with collusion citizens. Uniforce soldiers struggled to keep them behind cordons. Rhee hoped that Uniforce was still loyal to her, not Nero. She could replace the Ta'an, who were a small elite force of personal guards to the crown. But she couldn't replace the entire Uniforce army. Daisies were everywhere. Autocams on constant stream. They were technically called day-seas because of the light mounted on the bottom, but the word had been slurred over time into daisies.
They swarmed the windows of their vehicle, while Dalin's hand-picked guard of Fontizians rode moducycles on either side and swatted them away.
Rhiannon!
A voice screamed, loud enough to rise above the chorus. She saw a man crawl over a barrier and make a gesture so obscene as their vehicle passed that Rhi almost looked away. The man was tackled by one of Dalin's Fontizian guards, who'd gracefully launched himself off his moducycle. He had the man's head to the ground within seconds. Rhi swiveled to look behind her as they sped past.
Ancestors, Rhi hissed. Can't your men be more gentle?
She didn't want the Fontizian guard to give protesters more cause for unrest.
Don't forget that they're your men, he said.
She didn't answer. It's not how the Kalusians would see it. The guards were all Fontizian. And, like Dalin, they were part of the Order of the Light, a fundamentalist Fontizian religious group. The Order was obsessed with maintaining peace, even if that meant working with Kalu and supporting Ta'an rule. They'd favored her father. He'd brokered peace between their two planets and ended the Great War all those years ago. But that didn't mean the average Kalusian would be welcoming. To any Kalusian, a Fontizian was an outsider. Here was Rhi, their one true ruler, returned from the dead, flanked on all sides by security that, with their white blonde hair and sharp faces, looked a hell of a lot like the enemy, judging by some of the sneers and looks of real fear in the eyes of the crowd. She wondered whether it had been a good idea for the Order to take such a prominent role in protecting her. But no one else had offered to.
I don't want to get off on the wrong foot. The Order already has a reputation of being...
She searched for the right word.
Fanatical. Violent. Aggressive.
Dalin reached down to shift gears roughly. The vehicle was self-driving. But as usual, Dalin took no chances. He was worried, he said, that the tech would be hacked by Nero's cronies. There would be no accidents today.
I'm trying to make friends of enemies, she said defensively.
We will not apologize for our presence.
He scanned the packed streets of Kalusians as they passed. Fontizian spoke in negatives. It made everything they said sound forceful and stubborn. Though perhaps it was because they were forceful and stubborn.
Such a stance isn't an adequate strategy when it comes to dissenters.
Yes, because you have ruling a planet all figured out? He cocked his eyebrow as they stared at one another through the mirror.
Because you do, Empress?
Rhi exhaled slowly, but wouldn't respond. She was working on staying calmer, hiding her feelings better. That word, Empress, still felt wrong. She remembered when Julian had called her Empress in the Naufruma marketplace, as the meteors rained down above them the very last time she saw him. How the title had filled her with dread. Her purpose then had at least felt clear, violent but uncomplicated. One life for many. Siotra's for her families. But Siotra had been innocent. Her vengeance had been misguided. And she'd ended up killing one of her most powerful allies. Her purpose was different now, though just as clear as before. To bring about peace. They crested the hill, and for the first time in 6 years, Rhi caught sight, at last, of the palace. It took her breath away. It was the only thing from her childhood that had lived up to its memory, her organic memory. It was a feeling, different than the memories she had replayed on her cube. Better than the crystalline perfection that made it seem smaller and quaint on her cube. In person, it was majestic. Red and gold, 1,000 steps leading up to its entrance. The sun, as it set, looked as if it were slowly lowering itself on the southernmost spire, pierced open and dripping fire on the orange backlit sky. As enormous, as beautiful, as vast as it was, what struck her the hardest was how strongly she sensed her father. She could see him pacing the marble corridors just hours before they'd leave for good, because of the growing threat to their lives. Her mother's sobs that same night, bouncing between pillars in the fountain room. Only hours later, the craft that was supposed to take them to safety on Nau Fruma had exploded, killing them both. When she recalled a memory organically, like she did now, she experienced it with every sense, every facility she had. She was transported in time. Cube memories weren't like that at all. The cube was precise. It rushed to the very moment you needed it to, and then pulled away with the same cold efficiency. Not that it mattered. She'd temporarily turned off her cube so that they couldn't be tracked while they traveled. But there was another reason she hadn't turned her cube back on. A deeper, unspoken fear she couldn't yet voice. Nero's ambition to find the Overrider. Rhee didn't think it existed. Not really. It was a technology without precedent. And anytime she'd heard of it, it was only in conjunction with the G1K conspiracy theories. Only those on the fringes believed, or those like Nero, who were prone to dramatics and flair, ready to chase down any mirage to secure his reign. "Imagine being able to speak through any cube," he'd said on Hul, "to anyone at will, throughout the whole universe. Imagine being able to whisper to them, not through their ears, but their minds." Terror and revulsion snaked their way through her, but she didn't feel ready to tell Dalin, not yet. Not when the trauma of that night so obviously haunted him still. Nero had unofficially taken up residence in the palace after Rhee's supposed death. But her return had forced him to retreat, physically in this case. Still, her advisor, Tai Rayana, and her friend the fisherman, had been sent ahead to clear out the palace of any remaining Tassin and install the Fontizian guard and private security that could be trusted. It had been a flurry of prep in just a week's time between vetting loyalists and transporting them in secret. Dalin nudged the vehicle forward through the tall iron gates, nodding at the two Fontizian guards as he passed. The guards closed the gate quickly behind them, against a surge in the crowd. Some people crying, reaching out toward their pod, and others protesting, spitting as they passed. She vaguely made out the chant, "No more sharks," but she couldn't be sure. The slur for the Fontizians grated against her ears, making her ashamed of her own people. As the gates closed, she saw a fight break out. A man had thrown another to the ground, and they'd been swallowed up in the center of the crowd. She sat up straighter to get a better look. Dalin powered down the vehicle, and for a brief moment, Rhee thought she heard the engine ticking off the last of its charge. But that was her heart, not a drumbeat, but a kind of wild crackling. "There's a fight," she said to Dalin.
"There are fights everywhere. We're not to exit until the guards on the stairs are in place, and they've ensured..."
Before he could finish, she shouldered the door open and stood to face the crowd and look for the fight. The Fontizian guards rushed down the stairs toward her. But she held up both hands, demanding that they stay back. Dalin had gotten out himself and walked calmly around the vehicle, like he was stalking his prey, but stopped at a fair distance, just a few feet behind her, nodding at his guards to follow her order. Rhee's red dress flapped in the wind. She was close enough to the gate that the hem of her skirt pressed through the gaps in the iron rails. She put her hand to the metal, and the crowd grew silent. She'd say something now. Reassure them she was here, that the war would end, that peace would be restored. She felt their belief welling inside her,
and commanding the presence of her people. She felt a genuine ability to change the tide. Her eyes latched onto a blonde girl in the front ranks a few paces away on the steps. She held a bow and arrow, and her hair had been gathered in a thick braid that draped down her shoulder, practically alive, like a long white snake that she could charm. The girl's eyes were a hazel shade, yellows and oranges threaded through her irises, like the color of a now-Fruman sunset. The girl opened her mouth, as if to call words of encouragement. And then, from the other side of the gate, an egg launched into the air. There was a vacuum of silence, as if the thousands of people clamoring forward had held their breath. It landed with a crunch 3 meters short of where Reese stood. And for a split second, she was hyper-aware, focused on nothing but the vivid yolk pooling sadly against the drive. Then, everything exploded. Whole pockets of the crowd seemed to collapse, tumbling people down beneath its weight. She flinched as protesters threw even more things. Trash, rotten pulp of long-turned fruit, glass bottles that shattered at her feet. Her supporters turned on them. She heard screaming. Through the screams, she heard a hoarse whisper as someone from the crowd grabbed her through the rails, iron pressed into her face. "Daddy's girl better watch her back. No one wants you here. You took your sister's throne!" Ree yanked herself free. Something was spinning toward her, straight at her face. She dodged and nearly went down. Glass shattered with a high and hysterical noise. Gravel blasted her cheek. Dalin grabbed her arm. "Let go!" She struggled to regain her balance, stepping backward on her dress and feeling the hem rip. In a panic, she thought of the cameras watching, recording every second of this. Everyone across the galaxy would see that she was afraid, that she had no idea what she was doing. Nero would make sure of it. And even worse, she realized, was that it was true. When other rulers might have spent years cultivating a relationship with the public, she'd been planning Siotra's death on another moon in a foolish desire for vengeance. She'd been wrong. Now, she felt like a fool. Naive, like so many had said. "Let me go!" She managed to wrench free of Dalin. He started to yell. Ree wasn't sure what over the sound of the crowd. When she heard it, a high-pitched squeal like a firework shooting up into the air. Not a firework, though. It struck the top of the nearby tower in silence. Ree hoped it was a trick of the light. Then a massive blast of fire and a deep rumble as pieces of the marble tower cracked away, sifted through the air, masses of stone as big as the vehicle that had carried them. The crowd split. More screams. They dove for cover as the first stones hit with an impact that shook Ree through her feet all the way to her teeth. Dalin found her again and didn't bother with her hand this time. He hauled her over his shoulder and ran. They crashed through the double doors into the palace as more of the marble came shuddering down from the sky. Fontizian guards streamed in behind them before the doors closed with a resounding echo. From outside came the noise of splintering screams as protesters crashed through the barriers, shouts and thuds as the guards drove them backward. The uniformed soldiers that had been present earlier had mysteriously disappeared and left the riot to fester into this. More bottles exploded against the palace, and several eggs, too. They shimmered on the window panes, their yolks like suns dying in miniature. Empress Rhiannon was home. Chapter 3. Kara. Kara made her way up the staircase, taking 2 steps at a time as she dug the heel of her right palm into her eye socket to ease the building pressure. She hadn't stopped moving since she'd taken off from the dojo, and she wouldn't now. It was all about multitasking. Urge the blood vessels to relax, be patient, force her body to push through,
Fight. Get what's yours, Allie would have said.
Allie. She'd lost him in the crowd. Rhiannon's arrival back on Kalu had ignited something across the collusion territories. One second, Allie was behind Kara, and the next, he was gone. If she had only waited, they wouldn't be split up now. But if she had waited, the cylinder with the hollow message wouldn't be nestled in her pocket right now either. She hated how war had made everything split into either or.
Please let him be here, she thought, as she rushed up toward the roof.
Kara had been afraid Julian would follow her, so she had taken the long way back to Pavel. Returning had been its own kind of mission. The whole moon was protesting, and an explosive riot was the only reason she had made a clean getaway from the dojo. But on the way, she had seen Raetons and Fontizians rounded up by the Uniforce. It was illegal since the moon was neutral, but that hadn't stopped anyone. And Kara had done her best to be inconspicuous as she scanned the faces of the captured, some of them fearful, some furious, some in obvious shock. She hadn't seen Allie. When Kara got to the topmost floor, she saw the ladder had been pulled down. Her heart leapt. He was here. She scrambled up and popped her head through to see Pavel waiting for her. Just Pavel. "Where is he?" Kara asked as she heaved her leg over and crawled onto the roof. "I lost sight of him from the lookout. I hoped he would be accompanying you," the droid said. His eye lights went red, and his voice dropped. "It appears he is not." His metal frame retracted into its compacted dome setting, like he had collapsed out of sadness onto the floor. Kara knew how he felt. She was on her knees still, blinking into the setting sun, feeling the ache behind her eyes sink deeper and deeper into her skull. She trembled out of fear and frustration. And suddenly, the heat, the anger felt overwhelming, intense, like she'd burst into flame from the inside out. It was that same panicked feeling she'd gotten when she came home to her house ransacked and Lydia gone. That hadn't ended well. "They took him," she said. "They must have." Pavel didn't answer. He rolled toward her in his dome shape and nudged her shoulder gently. It made her feel a fraction better, a little less alone. But when his faceplate rotated toward her, she caught a glimpse of herself reflected back in its sheen. Her eyes were green. "They're changing color again," Allie had said. Kara had to let it be. She wouldn't be able to manage the sting of those eye drops with her headache this bad. She angled her face to the left. Was her face changing? And how long before anyone might guess who she really was? The lost Princess Jocelyn Ta'an. The possibility felt unreal, like a bad hologram that stuttered, a fractured projection. The same moment in low fidelity, looped over and over again. It was enough to drive a person crazy. But how could you reconcile these two identities? The city girl with the never-ending con, and the resurrected princess. But wasn't that the dream? Being royalty, putting on the red dress, the centerpiece in a parade while millions watched on? Maybe so. But the thought made Kara recoil. "You have a DNA cipher," Pavel said. "That's what it is?" Kara reached into her pocket and produced the wooden cylinder she'd taken from Julian. Allie would have been fascinated. He would have taken it apart and rearranged it, and she would have watched the fine movements of his hands, easing pieces in and out of place as he bit his lower lip, theorizing where it had been made and who could have sent it. "It's responsive to your fingertips alone. I detect sample cells that match yours embedded in the fiber of the wood." That's kind of gross, but kind of cool. It sounded like something Lydia would have loved. Had she left this for her? Or had the Lancer? Excitement shot through her again at the thought that this message was made for her and her alone. She placed it on the floor in front of her, and that same blue beam emitted, producing a hollow of the galaxy. The outer